From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. So we had a little dispute in a staff meeting the other day concerning the meaning of the word scoundrel. Kind of an old-fashioned word, right? You dirty, rotten scoundrel. Remember that Steve Martin, Michael Caine movie from the 80s? But here's the thing. What exactly is a scoundrel? Who would you call a scoundrel? Bernie Madoff? Yeah, we could probably agree on that. Well, we decided to do a show called American Scoundrels, and we thought we'd find some and invite them on. For one reason or another, Jack Abramoff said no, he didn't want to be on a show about scoundrels, but we found two who were willing to come on. One is a political opposition researcher, the other leads a cult. And we dug out some scoundrels from history, some uppity women, and a Civil War general who out-scoundrels them all. But we still needed a working definition of the word scoundrel, and for that, we headed to lexicographer Erin McKean. She's the founder and CEO of the online dictionary Wordnik. She's also the principal editor of the New Oxford American Dictionary. Steve Paulson sat down with her.
We asked you a few days ago to think about the word scoundrel. Have you figured out what it means?
Well, what it means is pretty straightforward. The word scoundrel, Samuel Johnson said it was a mean rascal, a low, petty villain.
Okay.
I don't think you can top that. I think, you know, Samuel Johnson said it. It hasn't really changed that much. The word scoundrel, though, I think has lately taken on a more approving tone.
Right.
Like you might say, oh, he's such a scoundrel, but you don't really mean he's a low, petty villain. You mean he's kind of a bad boy.
Yeah. What I found interesting is when you look at the synonyms that are listed in the Webster's Dictionary, it really covers the gamut. I just want to read some of these. Batty, beast, brute, devil, evildoer, fiend, heavy, hound, knave, meanie, miscreant, monster, Nazi, no good, rapscallion, rascal, reprobate, rogue, savage, scallywag, scamp, scapegrace, villain, varlet, wretch. So some of those are pretty nasty words, and some of them aren't so bad.
I think we never run out of ways to call people less than good, and we don't ever really get rid of the need to call people names either. There's an enormous number of synonyms for scoundrel and rapscallion and scalawag and so on in the Oxford Historical Thesaurus, just going back hundreds of years.
Now, you suggested that the definition has changed over the centuries since Samuel Johnson's time. Maybe it's become a little more favorable. I mean, there's sort of the playful element there, the con element. How do you explain that?
I think it's through a linguistic process that's sometimes called amelioration. So bad words get slightly better, often through metaphorical extension. So let's say that you're given perhaps to hyperbole, and instead of calling somebody, you know, unpleasant or unkind or immoral or a cheat, you're like, I'm going to reach for the word scoundrel so that people know the depth of my feeling, but I'm not necessarily saying he's headed for the gallows.
So I have to ask, would there be any circumstances where you would like to be called a scoundrel?
I think it would be enormously fun to be, say, in my 80s or early 90s and raising a great deal of heck. Well, I'd like to be the kind of little old lady who raises heck, you know, mischievous but not necessarily criminal.
I was wondering if there is, you know, are scoundrels among lexicographers, if that would be a badge of honor in some way.
Oh, that's an interesting question. I wonder what being a scoundrelish lexicographer would entail. Maybe making little permutations to alphabetical order to get people lost.
Oh, that's good. I like that.
If we all just declared that N and O were going to switch places in the alphabet and we'd all pretend not to understand when people said, you know, I used to think it went L-M-N-O-P, we'd be like, no, no, you're crazy. It's always been L-M-O-N-P.
Lexicographer Erin McKean is the founder and CEO of the online dictionary Wordnik. She was also the principal editor of the New Oxford American Dictionary. Steve Paulson spoke with her. Okay, so we might not have the perfect definition of the word scoundrel, but we can certainly agree on one thing. Civil War General and U.S. Congressman Daniel Sickles was the epitome of a scoundrel. Seriously. I mean, check out this list. Murder, political corruption, affairs with queens and prostitutes, and there's more than meets the eye about that leg he lost at Gettysburg. James Hessler is a Civil War guide at Gettysburg and the author of Sickles at Gettysburg. He filled in all the details and then some, like this issue of murder.
Well, I should point out in fairness that he was an acquitted murderer, but a murderer, embezzler, adulterer, kind of the stereotypical corrupt Tammany Hall politician of, you know, the 1850s. He came up through the streets of New York City through Tammany Hall's rough and tumble politics. And I think a lot of the lessons that he learned early in life fighting his way through Tammany Hall really kind of carried him through the long political and legal career that followed.
Yeah, it's almost hard to decide where to start in talking about Dan Sickles. But let's go to the murder first, because as you say, he was acquitted of that murder. But there isn't any question that he actually killed the son of Francis Scott Key.
No, there's really no question today that he killed Mr. Key, but what was in question at the time was, were his motives valid or not? Key was having an affair with Sickles' young wife, and Key was a district attorney in Washington while Sickles was a newly elected congressman. So these are two guys in the early stages of the James Buchanan administration who both have really high-flying careers in Washington. Well, unfortunately, Key takes a shining to Mrs. Sickles, and over the course of several months, Mrs. Sickles and Key, you know, embark on this affair. Sickles finds out about it because one night he receives an anonymous note in the mail, and within the following day, Sickles confronts Key on the streets of Washington and shoots him dead in Lafayette Square, which is, if you know Washington, D.C., is a park literally right across from the White House. So this murder is committed literally within a stone's throw of the White House in broad daylight in front of plenty of witnesses. Again, there's no question in anybody's mind whether or not Sickles did it.
Well, what happened after this? Everybody, I mean, there were a lot of witnesses. It was, as you say, in front of the White House. He shot him not once, not twice, but three times.
At least, and probably more if the gun had not misfired a couple of times. A way to get an easy laugh on your battlefield tours is to kind of refer to Dan Sickles as the O.J. Simpson of Gettysburg, because as you alluded to in your question, in terms of sensational murder trials, you could not ask for a better story. Because, I mean, it has everything, right? It had celebrities at the time, national celebrities, public figures, sex and adultery, which you can imagine in that era was extremely scandalous. Testimony and Therese's confession were censured in some markets, including San Francisco, of all places, for being obscene. So it was extremely scandalous with all of these titillating details within the trial. So Congressman Sickles turned himself in and basically assembled the equivalent of the dream team. He's got a lot of friends. He's got a lot of influence. He's a great friend with President Buchanan. They come up with this extremely novel defense, which ultimately will acquit him of the crime.
Now, we should mention what that extremely novel defense is, because it doesn't seem novel at all in modern terms, but at the time it had never been used before, right?
That's correct. So what happens is Sickles' attorneys basically present this case before the judge and the jury that Theresa Sickles and Mr. Key, Philip Barton Key, in having this affair, that basically by the moral codes and the standards of the time, that they were the ones who were in the wrong, and that Sickles was actually in the right for protecting his wife, who was considered his property. But the defense then goes a step further and basically tells the judge and the jury that that the thought, the very thought of Sickles' wife, you know, sleeping with another man basically drove Sickles crazy, and that he had killed Key basically in one of these temporary fits of passion, or what's become known today as the temporary insanity defense. And it's believed that the Sickles trial was the first time that this was ever used successfully in front of an American jury.
You can look at it and you can stop there and you can sort of understand, given the time, that that would happen. It might be worth mentioning, though, that already by this time, if I'm right about the history, he had been censured by the New York Assembly for bringing a prostitute into the assembly with him. That doesn't exactly fit with the high moral standards of the day, does it?
It doesn't, and that's what a lot of people find hypocritical about both Sickles and the case in general. Sickles is a chronic womanizer throughout his entire life, both from his early age up until, literally up until he dies. So he's a chronic womanizer, and he seems to have a propensity for favoring prostitutes. So the story that you alluded to there in his early years, before he had been married, he had carried on an affair with a prostitute in New York City by the name of Fanny White. She had run a high-end bordello in New York City, and prior to Sickles being married, he had carried on a fairly long-term relationship with her. So there are Sickles stories floating around today that, for example, when he was in England, he brought this prostitute over to England with him and introduced her to Queen Victoria and allegedly created a great scandal because of that. And that also, when he was in the New York Assembly, as you alluded to, he was censured by his outraged colleagues for bringing her onto the floor of the Assembly.
Well, this is the fascinating thing, isn't it? Because you have this, the scandals in New York politics, and then you have the murder in front of the White House when he's in Congress.
Yes.
Stays in Congress after that because he's acquitted of the murder, and then becomes a friend of the Lincoln family.
Yeah, and one of the things that's interesting about this guy, and I think makes him a quintessential American, is he's always able to sort of reinvent himself and shift from one career to the other. So when the Civil War starts, I think he's a very patriotic guy, but I also think he sees an opportunity here to possibly raise troops and kind of get back into the public limelight. And it's through the raising of troops, and as he runs into political opposition, he becomes friends with a new president in Washington, a guy by the name of Abraham Lincoln. And that's sort of how that relationship starts.
What's fascinating, again, about this, as you say, he reinvents himself. But what's fascinating about it is that he reinvents himself as a soldier with absolutely no experience whatsoever.
That's right.
Well, let's skip ahead to the key moment in his life, if you'll forgive the pun. I didn't mean it. Skip ahead to the battle at Gettysburg. He was a major general. He had his troops there, but he was under the command of General Meade. Can you just kind of lay out what happened at Gettysburg for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So at Gettysburg, he commands the 3rd Corps of the Union Infantry, which is about 11,000 men. Now, by this time, Sickles has risen up through the ranks and is the highest-ranking non-West Pointer, non-professional soldier in the Union Army. So he's a very high-ranking guy, and he's got a key position. To make a somewhat long story short, on the eve of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania native, professional soldier by the name of General George Meade has just been given command of the Union Army of the Potomac on the eve of Gettysburg. But what happens is Meade and Sickles hate each other's guts. They have a long personal, professional history together. They're just two very different guys. Sickles is the wild womanizer and the partier. Meade is the conservative, stay-at-home family man. So these are just two very different guys in and above their differences in professional training. So anyway, so at Gettysburg, as it turns out, on the 2nd of July, 1863, which is essentially the second day of the battle, Sickles' corps is ordered by General Meade to basically hold the left flank or the left end of the Union Army. Sickles doesn't like the position that he's ordered to be in, and it's literally a disaster waiting to happen. What happens is that when the Confederate Army begins its attack in the afternoon of July 2nd, Sickles decides that without orders and without telling General Meade, he's going to move his 11,000 guys into a different position, a position that General Meade does not realize Sickles should be in. So when the Confederates attack, much to General Meade's surprise, the entire left flank of the Union Army is out of line and in a position today that most historians agree is in a weaker position than the one General Meade wanted to put him in. So when the Confederates attack, Sickles just takes this onslaught of this attack, and many historians and critics have been arguing ever since, did he almost lose the battle for the Union Army as a result?
Or did he, as he always said, win the Union battle?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I find fascinating about him. You know, he's an early example of what we call spin today. After the battle, to sort of blunt criticism against him that, you know, some people were starting to say he almost lost the battle. Obviously, he wanted to put a good face on the battle for his friend Abraham Lincoln and things like that. Sickles starts a very elaborate spin campaign, which is going to go on for the next 50 years of his life, that not only did he not potentially lose the battle, but he actually forced General Meade into fighting at Gettysburg, and that you really deserved to give him a lot of the credit for winning the battle at Gettysburg.
Well, he managed to put a good spin on most things. I mean, one of the things we haven't talked about is that his leg was shattered by a cannonball at Gettysburg, right?
That's another famous Sickles anecdote. So during the closing phases of fighting on July 2nd, he's trying to rally his troops as his lines are literally falling apart, and a Confederate artillery shell comes over flying in his direction, basically smashes into his right leg, and he is carried off the battlefield where his leg is amputated that night. His military career really ends at Gettysburg because now that he's missing a leg, General Meade, remember Meade hates his guts anyways, but Meade can kind of now use a missing leg as one of the reasons to keep him from coming back to the army. Sickles, though, uses that missing leg really to great advantage. He spends the rest of his life, you know, this spin campaign that we've been talking about. Part of the spin campaign is basically telling people, look at my missing leg. Look at this great sacrifice that I made for the Union cause.
It's not just that, is it? I mean, it's the nature of this guy that he had his leg cut off, but he wouldn't let him throw it away.
Yeah, that's right. He wouldn't let him throw it away. So one of the well-known stories with Sickles is that the leg was donated in a nice coffined box to the fledgling Army Medical Museum in Washington, D.C., which until very recently was at Walter Reed. Mark Twain got to know Sickles late in life. Twain wrote about Sickles that basically he said, I think General Sickles values the leg that he's lost more than the one that he's still got. And if he had to lose one, I think he would rather lose the one that he still has. And I think that's kind of a good quote on, you know, how Sickles treated that missing leg.
James Hessler is a Civil War guide at Gettysburg, and he's the author of Sickles at Gettysburg. Now, Sickles' life didn't end there. He was appointed to Spain as a diplomat, where he almost started a war, and had an affair with Queen Isabella II. If you would like to see that famous leg, you can go to the National Museum of Health and Medicine in Silver Spring, Maryland. Or you can come to our website to see a photo, ttbook.org. Scoundrel is such an old-fashioned word. I mean, who uses it anymore? Are there scoundrels today? We thought so. We look no further than the world of political opposition research, shadowy political operatives who dig up the muck on a candidate's opponents. Those running for office? Adultery, back taxes, DUIs, illegitimate children? You name it, they find it. And Strange Champs caught up with an opposition researcher named Alan Huffman for a primer on the dark side of American politics. He's the co-author of We're With Nobody, and asked what his clients expect.
Well, the expectation is that we'll deliver a bombshell about their opponent, which doesn't happen as often as you might think, but the candidate is going to expect us to at least portray their opponent in a way that they can be able to use in the campaign. But what most people don't realize is that we also do this to the candidate we're working for. You know, we
That must be an unwelcome discovery.
Oh, yeah. We don't win a lot of popularity contests. You know, we see everybody naked, and for better or worse. And so when we turn in our reports, we're going to tell you everything that you need to know about your opponent, but also everything you need to know about yourself.
So what happens when you're sitting across from a candidate and you have to slide a folder across the desk and you have to say, "And I think you might want to take a look at what's in here," and it's all about them?
It's awful. That's our least favorite part of the job, because the candidate never wants to hear what is wrong with him. And they have to do it, because that way they'll know what the other side has got, because the other side has got somebody just like us out there doing the exact same things. And sometimes we actually catch their scent. You know, we'll be in a courthouse and they'll say, "Well, somebody was in here yesterday asking for the exact same information." So, you know, they're out there, and that's why the candidate has to do it. But it doesn't make it any more pleasant when you have to say, "Oh, by the way, you've been late paying your taxes 4 times and they're overdue right now. And maybe you should go over there like this afternoon."
Did that actually happen to you?
That actually happened. And I mean, it comes with the territory. And what's surprising is, you know, you often hear from the candidate, "Why should I hire you to tell me about myself? And, you know, where do we start?" Because so many people, A, either don't remember the things that they've done, or haven't put them in context to see what the ramifications might be politically, or sometimes they have intentionally concealed it because they're hoping no one will find it. So,
have you wound up, you must have been in situations where you're working for somebody, a candidate, and partway through the research you think, you know, this guy's really a slime ball?
Yes. It's inevitable, right? I mean, your party is not always right. And even if you agree with what the person represents, it doesn't mean that they're a good potential leader. So, yeah. And you know what? Usually when that happens, they lose. You know, Michael and I, we can easily spot it, and we'll say, you know what, the opponent is the stronger of the two. And in most cases, not always, but in most cases, the opponent wins.
But on the other hand, there must be plenty of times when, you know, you provided some information and then later, I don't know, you're sitting in a bar and you watch some horrible attack ad come on for which you know that you provided the information.
Right. Well, yeah, sometimes we watch on the news and we'll say, okay, yeah, that's good. They seized on the right thing and the voters embraced it and that was that. But oftentimes we'll see the opposite. We'll see the ad where our side or the other side distorts, you know, the findings. We're trained in the print media, so we're not used to speaking in 15 and 20 second sound bites. And so when we see our work reduced, we inevitably cringe, because there's always more to the story than that. But sometimes they're right on, and that kind of is fulfilling for us.
Really? So even if it's a really horrible ad that's attacking another candidate, but you think they got the facts right, you feel proud of that?
Yes, absolutely. Because, you know, for example, we did a campaign where this guy had failed to pay his taxes, had bought a yacht during the same period he wasn't paying his taxes. He had borrowed a state-owned RV that was supposed to be used for disaster response, driven it to a NASCAR race with his buddies, had wrecked it, had sentenced a guy to 1 year in prison for child molestation when he could have sentenced him to 14 years. The guy got out in a year and murdered a priest. And so, yeah, all this is really negative stuff, right? And we were very happy when all that came out. Because if there's anything you need to know about a guy who you're thinking about selecting as a leader, those are things you need to know.
I guess one of the things I found so interesting reading your book is, you know, on the one hand, like everybody else in America, I've seen more than my fair share of negative campaign ads. So I was expecting the book to be full of, you know, you're skulking around back alleys and paying people to give you interesting information. And no, you're spending all your time in kind of white collar clerical offices paging through mind numbing descriptions of, you know, tax records.
Well, not all of our time. As you know from reading the book, that is certainly the part that most people don't think about, that we do. Yeah, we're going through the tree pruning committee minutes and trying to find some example of someone making a misstep. And you do. You spend days going through these records. But you also, as we describe in the book, you know, we end up sitting on the porch of a trailer with a guy that has a shotgun across his lap because he thinks someone's going to kill him for talking to us. And we get followed by a couple of thugs in a rusty pickup truck for days, or maybe if it's in a big city, some guy in a Lincoln Town Car that every time we look back, he's back there. So you know there's a lot at stake in politics, and we get threatening phone calls and these sorts of things. And it's really it's a mix of these sorts of episodes and then the boring tedium. But the things that we look for when we see someone trying to intimidate us or throw obstacles in our path, it just tells us we're getting warm.
How secretive are you about what you're doing?
We used to be a lot more secretive than we are now. I mean, we still will be if the candidate is sensitive to that. But when we started out doing this, the danger was that your opponent would come out with a, you know, hold a press conference and say that his opponent, who is our guy, has hired private investigators to smear me. And, you know, and everyone was kind of afraid of that. But now everyone knows that it's done. I mean, you know, if especially look at this particular Republican presidential primary, opposition research is sort of in the lexicon now and in the public mind. People know that it is done and everybody does it. So it's not really, it doesn't have that sort of secret air about it that it once did. But needless to say, you know, the truth can be painfully shy. So we don't make a big deal about it when we're digging. That is still an issue for us. We drift into town. We ask our questions, we get our records, and we move on. And most of the time, no one's ever even going to know we were there.
It's kind of like these, I don't know, sinister political hitmen roaming the landscape of America.
Yeah, people say, oh, it's so glamorous. It's like espionage. And I'll say, yeah, it's like espionage in the sense of two middle-aged spies roaming the Midwest in a rented Hyundai.
Yeah, Alan, we're talking to you in the context of a show on scoundrels, and frankly, I suggested getting you on because I thought an opposition researcher, that seems kind of like somebody who's sort of professionally paid to be a scoundrel, but you sound really moral and upright.
Well, of course. Why would I indicate otherwise? No, I appreciate the vote of confidence, but you know, I can certainly see the argument being made that we're part of an overall negative process. But our position really is that it's just about determining what's true. And I mean, that sounds really lofty and it sounds a little suspicious, seeing as how we work in politics. But it is possible to get to the bottom of things. It is possible to find out who these people are who are proposing to lead you and pass laws that are going to govern your life. I mean, you can find out about them. And it's easier actually now than it used to be. I mean, there's so many, every state has an open records law. A lot of it is available online. There are websites that do nothing but validate, you know, vet basically statements by candidates and that sort of thing. So the irony is that at this time when there's so many people putting untruths and half-truths out there, that we're really in a point where it is possible to find out what's true. So, yeah, you could argue that we're kind of scuzzy. We're just out there, you know, looking for trouble, trying to make life miserable for everybody. And I understand that people see that in what we do. But what we're driven by is just finding out what the truth is. Unfortunately, we have no control over it once we create that document and turn it over, we're done. It's someone else's job, and anything can happen from that point on.
Alan Huffman is the co-author of We're With Nobody. Two insiders reveal the dark side of American politics, and Strange Champ spoke with him. Don't go away. More scoundrelly rapscallions and rogues to come. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking about great American scoundrels. And so far, frankly, somebody's missing. Women. Where are the female scalawags? The lady rogues? Well, Anne Strangechamp set out to rectify that situation. She called up Elizabeth Mahon, author of the blog and the book of the same name, Scandalous Women.
Elizabeth, we've been talking about scoundrels in this hour, and I hope that I am not the only woman who is feeling a little annoyed and kind of curious about why, when people think of famous scoundrels, they mostly seem to think about men. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it has to do with the definition of scoundrel. We think of a scoundrel as sort of Rhett Butler from Gone with the Wind, that sort of wink and a nod and, you know, sort of a very sexy man. Women, I think, for the most part in history, are seen as sort of, you know, the woman behind the man, which I think is sort of a disservice to all the fabulous women out there who were out there kicking butt and taking names just as the men were. But I think that's part of the reason why. I mean, women tend to fall into the category of either spinsters or sluts, or they're not really seen as scoundrels. And I think that's a shame, because I think there are quite a few women that could be considered scoundrels.
Well, maybe we also unconsciously think that women are too well-behaved to become scoundrels.
And that is so not true, as there's that famous quote that well-behaved women don't make history.
Enshrined on countless bumper stickers and T-shirts.
Which is true, and I think women are less well-behaved than I think history gives us credit for. But as we know, for the longest time, history was written by men, so I think that's also part of the problem.
Let's rescue some of history's most scandalous, scoundrelly women from pages of history. Who would you name as some of the most notorious scoundrelly women?
Oh, well, one of my favorite women is Victoria Woodhull, who was the first woman ever to run for president of the United States way back in 1872. Not many people know about her, which is unfortunate because she is fabulous. She was born in 1838 in Ohio. She came from a very poor, hardscrabble family. Her father was basically a con artist, and her mother practiced what was called mesmerism back then, which I guess is, we call it hypnosis now. And they would travel the revival circuit, and her mother would go into trances, start speaking in tongues. And young Victoria was brought up on stage as a child and induced to bring on these trances. And that's how she basically made her living up until probably about 20 years old.
So she was kind of a second-generation con artist.
Yes, yes. And she learned how to, you know, work a crowd. You know, so much of that is learning body language. So that's how she got her start. She married for the first time when she was 14. Married an older man, a doctor, who was basically an alcoholic. So she had to find her own way, because certainly her husband wasn't going to support her. So she dumped him, moved with her sister to New York, where she became one of the first women to run her own brokerage firm.
She ran a brokerage firm?
Yes, she did.
There couldn't have been any other women on Wall Street at the time.
No, there were not. She and her sister, Tennessee, her younger sister, who was her close confidant and buddy, they came to New York with Victoria's second husband, a Colonel James Blood, who was supposedly a Civil War veteran, and they made the acquaintance of the Commodore, Cornelius Vanderbilt. They held seances for him because Cornelius wanted to speak to his mother. From him, they got all their stock tips. I think there's actually even a story that Tennessee used to sit on his lap while she was doing the seances.
Wait, so these are two seance-holding women who get their tips from their seance victims or clients,
yes,
and who then use those tips to open a brokerage house?
Yes.
It's going to be the original insider trading.
They made a great deal of money, and from that, they started their own newspaper. They were the first women to own their own newspaper, where they promoted things like sex education, free love, vegetarianism, women's rights. They were, of course, very big on women's rights. And they also published the first English version of Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto.
Doesn't she seem like the kind of bad girl every mother would want her daughter to know about?
Yes. And every bad girl that we now would want her to be.
Right. Now, you mentioned a few others. Let's see. Who else? Margaret Sanger?
Ah, yes. Margaret Sanger. Of course, Margaret Sanger has been in
the news because it's an election year and the Republicans have been swinging her name right and left as the big sinner because of her advocacy of birth control.
And she was one of the original, sort of the founder of the women's right for reproductive freedom.
What we now know of as Planned Parenthood came out of her original work promoting birth control.
Now, I'm trying to remember why Margaret Sanger chose birth control as her chief issue. There was something about her mother, wasn't there? Didn't her mother go through some horrific number of pregnancies?
There were two reasons. Number one, her mother in 20 years went through 18 pregnancies. 11 of those pregnancies lived, and then she had 7 miscarriages. That completely wore out her mother, and her mother also had tuberculosis, and the pregnancies exacerbated that situation. So she died relatively young at the age of 50 from the TB, and I think she also had cervical cancer. So that was one of the impetuses for Margaret's crusade. The other one was working as a nurse on the Lower East Side. She saw so many women who either had gone and had backstreet abortions or who had tried to abort the child themselves. Mm-hmm. And she just found that appalling that these women were having to go through that. And everywhere she went, women were begging her for help. Please, can you give me something to prevent pregnancy? And she had nothing.
And not only did she have nothing, it was illegal to distribute any kind of contraceptive, wasn't it?
It was definitely illegal. I mean, you know, you could find condom somewhere, but you know, you couldn't talk about it, you couldn't promote it. For the most part, only middle class or upper middle class women had the resources. I mean, they could go to Europe because birth control was widely available in Europe and by whatever diaphragms which were available in Europe. And so, you know, it was possible for them to limit their childbearing, but not for poor women. And Margaret just found that appalling that there was such an inequity.
I'm curious. You know, just recently, contraception has been in the news again.
Yes.
Rush Limbaugh, for instance, is rather notoriously vilified a Georgetown University law student who campaigned to have contraceptives covered by health insurance. He called her publicly several times a slut and a prostitute. Did similar things happen to Margaret Sanger?
Well, definitely, because, you know, what Margaret was promoting was not just limiting pregnancies, but she also felt that birth control meant that you no longer were having sex just to have children. It meant that you could just have sex just to have sex. And that sex was fun, which, you know, back then was considered shocking and a sin. And clearly there are people now who feel that, you know, the idea of women having sexual feelings is not a good thing, as witnessed Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah, shocking for women, but not for men.
No. And from the 19th century until the early 20th century, women weren't considered to have sexual feelings. You only submitted to your husband in order to have children. It was sort of a burden. And what Margaret Sanger was saying was, no, sex is a wonderful, beautiful thing between two people. And with birth control, you can enjoy this without having to worry about the fear of getting pregnant.
Doesn't it strike you that when women are accused of being scoundrels, it almost always involves sex in some way or another? I mean, it's either because they broke the sexual mores of the time, or if not, they're accused of breaking them, and they're called sluts and indecent, whether they are or aren't. I mean, no one calls male scoundrels sluts.
No, they don't. I mean, you know, there is the term man whore, but not many people use it. I think
I've never
it's
even
because...
heard it. Man whore? I like that one.
I think it's because men feel threatened by women who take control of their own power, who don't rely on men to support them, or because they're free thinking, they have their own thoughts. So therefore, she must be a slut, or there must be something wrong with her that she feels like she needs to do this.
Well, again, we're still struggling to find a woman scoundrel who actually would either a woman scoundrel that I wouldn't admire. I sort of paged through your book looking for somebody who I actually thought had done something bad. And the only ones I found were these two women pirates. And they truly were.
Oh,
I mean, they were murderers.
Yeah, Anne Bonny and Mary Read.
Yeah. So tell us about them.
Anne Bonny was the daughter, she was the illegitimate daughter of an Irish aristocrat and his mistress, and they fled to the States, where Anne was raised to be a proper young girl, and of course didn't want to do that, that was boring to her. So she ran off with a pirate and ended up in the Caribbean on his ship. In fact, I think she was a better pirate than he was, Calico Jack.
Didn't she decide he was kind of a wimpy pirate and she could do it better?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. And she decided that she could do it better than he did. And she met Mary Read. The story goes that Mary Read was dressed as a boy on the ship and that she was sort of found out. But they were, yeah, they were these great pirates and managed to, when they finally got captured, to claim that they were both pregnant and to keep from being hung.
Well, I'd probably do that too if it meant not hanging. Well, there's this great story you tell about how Calico Jack, years later, her ex-lover, years later, he was caught and was hung. Right before they hung him, he asked to see Anne. And she says this totally harsh thing. She says, had you fought like a man, you need not have been hanged like a dog.
Don't you just love that? Kick a man when he's down, about to be hung.
Ouch. So, you know what this makes me think is women get, it seems so unfair that it doesn't really take a whole lot of transgression for women to be considered scoundrels. And yet, if you ask people to name the top scoundrels they can think of, they're going to name all men.
And I think it's because they don't really know a lot about these women. I mean, one of the reasons why I wrote the book was to either remind people who already knew about these women that these women existed, and also for a whole new generation of young women out there to say, you know, here are these women from Cleopatra on up who were out there taking names, fighting the good fight, just opening the doors so that we could walk through and have the lives that we have.
Let's hear it for scandalous women.
Yes.
Thank you so much for talking.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Mayen's the author of a book and a blog called Scandalous Women. The blog even has a Scoundrel of the Month. Anne Strainchamp spoke with her. What about you? Do you have a favorite woman scoundrel? Tell us about her. You can email us at ttbook.org or put a comment on our Facebook page. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. You probably can't get more scoundrelly than a snake oil salesman, somebody who uses charm to pry on a trust and sell us something, usually false hope. We found a modern-day huckster. His name is the Reverend Ivan Stang, and he's the co-founder of a cult called the Church of the Subgenius. Its members worship a pipe-smoking man-god named Bob Dobbs, and they claim to be a superior race descended from the Yeti. Their theology is summed up in one word. Slack. Steve Paulson asked Reverend Stang if the Church of the Subgenius should be taken seriously or is a joke.
Everyone should take all of it seriously up to a point. That point is the tricky part. And that's why I say we want only the highest quality zombies. We have a tendency, apparently, to attract either the most talented, interesting people, or the absolutely most obnoxious, obsessive types of folks. You know, what we're trying to sell is an antidote to snake oil, and most of our customers understand that. They've been burned by some kind of snake oil in the past, and when they get ordained as a subgenius minister, I think they know what they're doing. But every now and then, we find somebody who goes, hey, wait a minute, this isn't snake oil. This is an antidote to snake oil. I wanted the snake oil. I wanted to meet Bob. You know, Bob is our guru.
Okay, well, you have to explain. Who is Bob?
J.R. Bob Dobbs was originally a salesman, a very, very talented salesman, who got into the religion business in the 1950s, kind of a do-it-yourself religion, when he was seized up in the spirit by the alien space god Jehovah One, who has posed as the Lord to various civilizations over the centuries. This creature, space monster, whatever, told Bob that in the year 1998, the weirdos and the different, who were termed the subgeniuses, which is, kind of includes anybody under the level of genius, which is most people, those are the saved and will be lifted up on the escape vessels of the sex goddesses on July 5th, 1998.
Okay, well, I have to ask more about Bob. There's a picture that always comes up of him. I mean, he looks like he's this, you know, this 1950s guy, and he's always, you know, he's got a pipe, which does raise the question of, you know, what is he smoking? Tell me about this image.
That image is actually a piece of clip art that we found. It's now our trademark. At the time that we located it, it was just something from the Yellow Pages. But if you look at any old magazines from the 50s and 60s, you'll see these ads with these square-looking, good-looking guys with pipes. They're usually relaxing in a hammock or going fishing, and there's usually some cute blonde housewife sweeping up. That's Bob's mate, Connie.
Now, I want to get a sense of how one becomes a member of the Church of the Subgenius. I guess it just means you got to send in $35, right?
Yeah, that's actually literally true. All it takes to prove that you are a subgenius is to send $35 to subgenius.com. Now, just because you send in that $35 doesn't mean that you're a true subgenius, but you certainly have the right to call yourself one. Bob used to hang out with L. Ron Hubbard, and back in the 40s, L. Ron said to Bob, "You know, Bob, they may be pink," meaning normal or stupid, stupider than a subgenius even, "but their money is green. So we'll take anybody's $35. Sometimes they meet such wonderful people that they end up getting married. I've performed, I've lost count of how many legal marriages.
Actually an ordained minister, right, of the Church of the Subgenius. So in other words, you can perform marriages.
Well, I'm also ordained in the Universal Life Church, praise the ULC. Like us, there's a lot of spinoffs. Beware of expensive imitations.
So $35 will get you a membership, a lifetime membership, I guess, into the Church of the Subgenius. What do you get for that $35?
It's a pretty big package of stuff. But the most important thing is that your name is registered on the Book of Life, which then goes to the men from Planet X or the Exists or sex goddesses or whatever they are, so that they'll know when X Day finally comes who to rupture up onto their own space vessels. You could turn it into your own planet if you want to at that point. And you can get revenge on everybody you ever hated. Although that becomes a problem when you want to get revenge on a fellow subgenius who also suddenly has his own battle planet. I've already got dibs on certain things that we want to preserve from Earth, like the Grand Canyon and the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam.
So the idea is that you will end up in heaven, right? I mean,
In subgenius heaven. Well, basically, what we offer is eternal salvation or triple your money back. If at the end of eternity you can prove you didn't get salvation, Bob will be waiting at the gates of hell with a check for $110, ready to sell you a book called Hell on $5 in Eternity for, I think, $104.95, something like that.
So you just about break even then.
Yeah. You can't go wrong. It's a win-win situation unless you happen to be one of those Bobbies, we call them, the ones who, like I say, they take the jokes seriously and they think that the buried truths, because we actually try to impart a certain amount of hidden wisdom, like any occult group.
Well, you have a theology, right? The theology.
Yeah, but some people
slack.
Think that part's the joke, and they think the jokes are the serious part because we do want to seduce people into joining them by entertaining them. That's why our books are in they're marked humor, and the radio show seems to cause people to laugh. Actually, there's three different broadcast and syndicated Subgenius radio shows. The Hour of Slack that I do, Puzzling Evidence out of Berkeley, and Bob's Slack Time Funhouse out of Atlanta, which is produced by Reverend Susie the Floozy.
So these are all affiliated with the Church of the Subgenius?
Well,
or are these offshoots? Are these fringe groups?
Actually, they're old friends of mine, and they're schisms of the church. When you join the Subgenius thing, you're encouraged to buy all the accessory kits, but then to get sick and tired of it and start your own religion. Because here's the thing. Bob calls himself a short-duration personal savior, or Shordurpa Sav in the original Tibetan. You know, we live in a throwaway culture. Obsolescence is designed into things, and it was kind of designed into the Church of the Subgenius because we don't want people using Bob as a crutch. Bob uses you as a crutch. It doesn't matter what Bob has in his pipe. He has you in his pipe. He's smoking you. Now, some people say the pipe itself is smoking Bob. That sounds good.
I guess
so. I just
so.
Came up with a new one.
Yeah, there you go.
I was probably channeling Bob. I'll probably have a terrible headache for the rest of the day after saying that.
But let's leave things of this world behind and walk now down the path of Bob for this brief minute of slack from the Church of the Subgenius.
What now? What did you say?
It only makes noise when I open it or close it. It doesn't make noise and, like, talk to me like I thought you meant when you said that.
Well, we'll try and close it and open it very gently.
Wrap it around your head and listen real carefully to the printed letters on that book. The Bible is a beautiful story, but this book is even better. But the single rule of the Church of the Subgenius is, f*** them if they can't take a joke. Let me say that again. F*** them if they can't take a joke. I've had to do that edit a lot of times myself. You know, because we're on broadcast radio, too.
Yeah.
Just not as much as you are.
God made light, light, day, light, stars, sky, day, light, dark, morning, day.
The Reverend Ivan Stang is co-founder of the Church of the Subgenius. Steve Folsom spoke with him. For a link to their weekly radio program, which sounds a lot like what you just heard, go to our website at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For more information on The Great American Scoundrel, please go to our website at ttbook.org, where you will find a wealth of past interviews with great thinkers, creators, and agitators. If you want to keep an eye on what's on our minds, follow us on Facebook or Twitter. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Ann Strainchamps. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Carill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.